club football, he pisses all over him. So
yeah. It's just Messi. We all know what Messi can do.
A lot of flair, a lot of skill.
People might forget the names, but the streets certainly won't.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the FT LOL podcast, or should I say Guten Tag. Today, we are looking into the Bundesliga, and I'm honoured to be joined by the face of German football in the UK, Mr. Raphael Honigstein. How are you doing, sir?
I'm very well. Thank you for your kind introduction. Very nice.
Good stuff. Good stuff. So, yeah, we're going to be looking at the greatest Bundesliga 11 of your lifetime. But before we get into that, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself. Sort of when did you get into football, really?
So I started watching football consciously in 1980. And went to my first game in, I think, 82, 83. I grew up in Munich, so Bayern Munich was pretty close to my heart and is reflected in some of the choices I've made. But yeah, also, of course, the fact that they have been pretty dominant in recent years, and good footballers tend to end up at Bayern. I moved to London in 1993. And what else can I tell you? I think you sort of know the rest. I fell into football while studying and been doing this job now for 20 years.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's fair to say when people think of German pundits in UK football, I think you're the first name that people would sort of lean to, really. I mean, you're everywhere these days, BT Sport, The Athletic. You come up every now and again on Sky Sports and things like that. And yeah, it's good to have you on, because I'm interested to do a bit more in continental football. We probably do tend to look at the Premier League a bit more in this podcast. And football obviously didn't start in 1992. So it's good to venture a bit further back. I would say that sort of when you were growing up, Germany were sort of dominant, but I don't think there has really been a period where Germany haven't been winning things or getting to finals or anything like that, really. And yeah, as sort of England fan, can't really say that. Not many people have been around to see 1966, unfortunately. But yeah, it's been a good ride, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been pretty good. But it's different now. I think in the 80s, German football was successful, but not very pretty. And we were often the villain of the piece. And then there was a period when we had relatively unsuccessful years. And since then, we've come back. And now I think it's much harder to take offense or to dislike the side, because they play good stuff and they're by and large nice players as well. So it's more fun now for me than it was when they won stuff in the 80s or got far in the 80s and then won in 1996.
Yeah, and was it around 2001, around that time when it was the sort of restart in German football?
Yeah, I mean, the problems that exposed by the two disastrous Euro campaigns in 2000-2004, they were being addressed both sort of at grassroots level from the late 90s onwards, but really starting in earnest in the new century. And at the same time, at the top of the tree, if you will, 2004 then brought in Jürgen Klinsmann and Oliver Bierhoff and their new ideas. And since then, the reformation, if you will, of German football has gathered pace, both in terms of what happens in the national team, but also more importantly, perhaps even what happened and continues to happen at academy level, where Germany really overhauled its whole development structure and its coaching and has started to produce much, much better players.
Yeah, and that's sort of what you talk about in your book, isn't it? Das Reboot, in that sort of period. So we've seen a sort of golden age, I suppose, or we've just been past the golden age in German football, the national team. But in terms of the Bundesliga, when would you say, sort of in your lifetime, that it's been at its peak as a league?
Well, I think we've had several peaks and troughs. When you say my lifetime, I didn't include any of the Bayern players from the 70s because while I was alive, I wasn't quite old enough to take part in that experience. But of course, in the mid-70s, late-70s, the German football, both domestically, but more importantly in Europe, was very dominant and was able to attract international superstars like Kevin Keegan and so forth. And then I guess in the mid-80s, then suddenly you see Serie A taking over. And that lasts until the late 90s when the Premier League starts to rise and the two Spanish clubs start pulling away, the two big ones. And since then, I think the Bundesliga has been really about Bayern plus Dortmund in stages, trying to keep up with everyone. Although I'm hopeful that recent successes like Frankfurt winning the Europa League and Leipzig going quite far and maybe Leverkusen having a good season next year will show that there is a bit of depth there as well.
Yeah, because I think with Frankfurt winning it, that makes the Bundesliga the most represented club, doesn't it? The most represented league in Europe next season because you can have 8 clubs. So, yeah, you can put that way. It's a lot of, well, hopefully a lot of depth in the league, and it gets tarnished a little bit with Bayern dominating, which, you know, as a Bayern fan, I don't think you'll complain about too much. But, yeah, it's good to see sides like that pop up. And do you think, I mean, if one was to sort of put their head above the water and be the main challenger to Bayern over the next few years, do you reckon that's still Dortmund? Or is it going to be someone else, do you feel?
Unfortunately, it's hard to see anyone else being anywhere close to Bayern. Even Dortmund have struggled since Jürgen Klopp has left. Since Thomas Tuchel has left. It's because Bayern's financial dominance just translates into quality, both collectively and individually. And it's very, very hard against a side that has such a head start to make any progress. There was a bit of weakness when Niko Kovac was there. Bayern, in inverted commas, only amassed 78 points. Dortmund ended up on 76. I think they could have easily won it that year. And then we'd be having a slightly different conversation. It wouldn't quite look so bad for the Bundesliga with 10 Bayern wins in a row. But even with that possible Dortmund win puncturing Bayern's dominance, it is very hard without very big structural reforms and Bundesliga clubs opening themselves up to investment to see how the dynamic will change anytime soon.
I suppose as has been the trend in recent years, when there is a player from a rival side, Bayern will tend to snap them up, won't they? And yeah, I think we've seen that for years. Is that because Germans don't tend to move, I suppose, as much as some of their European counterparts? I suppose we see it with English players and Italians to an extent as well, but is that generally why do you think they sort of stay with Bayern, or is it the guaranteed success?
Well, I mean, Bayern would love it to be the way you describe it, but unfortunately it's no longer the case. Bayern are increasingly losing out when it comes to the best Bundesliga players and the best German players, as you see with the likes of Havertz and Werner and De Bruyne and Konate, and there's so many others who Bayern cannot buy for one reason or another. Or cannot keep, like Thiago, or like Alaba. And the problem is that Bayern don't have it all for themselves, but that doesn't really help the others very much, because if the best Dortmund player doesn't go to Bayern, like Sancho or Haaland, they will go somewhere else, namely to the Premier League. So Bayern's dominance in absolute terms might become smaller because they find it increasingly hard to keep their own players and to pick the best players from the Bundesliga, as was the case until about 5-6 years ago, but it's changed now. But in relative terms, the dominance is still very, very big and hard to shift.
All right. So do you want to start with your 11 then? So in goal, I mean, this is, I know we're talking all Bundesliga here, but even if you just look at Germany, I mean, some of the goalies that Germany have had in your lifetime is absolutely ridiculous, the level. So yeah, this is one of the positions I'm most interested to see if you've picked, actually.
Well, as you said, I could have picked any amount of players, going all the way back to a player that you probably won't know and not many listeners know, but there was a Belgian keeper in Germany called Jean-Marie Pfaff. He'd been outstanding in the 1986 World Cup for Belgium, and he then moved over to Bayern. And he was just wonderful. In fact, I think he moved even earlier. I think it was after the 82 World Cup. Either way, some wonderful goalies. And of course, recency bias is always a danger, but I think, having seen a lot of them, that the guy who's still in goal now for both Germany and Bayern might trump them all. And of course, his name is Manuel Neuer. The reason I give it to Neuer is because not only is a superb goalkeeper in the classic sense, does all the stuff you want from a goalkeeper, dominate the box, strong reactions, strong one-on-one saves, good on penalties, but of course also a really good footballer. And he's enabled both Bayern and Germany to play in a much more progressive way, modern way, because of his skill and his ability to come out and eat up that space that high lines inevitably tend to leave. So Manuel Neuer gets the vote for me.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I had a feeling you might have said him or Kahn, but I think the performance that comes to mind for me for Neuer has got to be that Algeria one at the World Cup. I've never seen anything like it from the goalkeeper. I mean, I don't know how Germany got through that game, but obviously Neuer was superhuman that day. And as you said, he does do all the conventional things that a goalie does as well. And although goalies are moving more to ball-playing players, I think the very top ones have still got that kind of one-on-one ability and, you know, commanding their box and things like that. So yeah, that's a top shout, really. I'm not surprised in the slightest. So formation wise, have you gone four at the back?
Well, I've sort of gone with a classic German formation from the 70s, which is three at the back, only one centre back, and then a sweeper just in front of the defence.
Okay.
So on the right, although he could have also been on the left or in midfield, is Philipp Lahm, captain of Bayern, captain of the World Cup winning team in 2014. Again, lots of contenders, but Lahm is the guy who freakishly never gave the ball away. Having watched him for 15 odd years, I can count on one hand the number of times he made a mistake, let alone had a bad game. It just did not happen for him. Just ridiculously versatile, gifted, close control, hard to play against. Yeah, the most complete fullback that Germany has ever seen. I don't have any doubt in that.
That ability to play on either side as well, because I think when I probably first came about him was he's saying left back, but you know, he naturally a right back, and then he moved into midfield. So yeah, as you say, so versatile. Was it Pep that said he was the most intelligent player he's ever coached? Was that about Philipp Lahm?
I think he said one of the most, but
okay.
Pep was never shy when it came to dishing out compliments to his players. Sometimes you have to be a bit careful because The people who got praised most were then shunted out the week after. But I think in his case, it was genuine, and I think everyone can concur that Lahm was a super clever all-round footballing machine.
Yeah, yeah. So in this sort of formation that you've got from Germany played in the 70s, is he quite wide like he typically would be in the game, or is it sort of quite condensed in that middle three? Is he more of a full-back, I suppose, rather than a right centre-back? Or
Yeah, he's a full-back. What is quite interesting to watch those games back, Germany starts playing a very fluid style where full-backs would go forward and interchange positions. And that was one of the reasons why their game and the Dutch game, certainly at club level, but to an extent also internationally, was so ahead of the curve in the 70s, because against men-marking systems, suddenly full-back sweepers came forward and there was no one there, because nominally they would have been marked by the strikers. And of course, the strikers didn't track all the way back to their own box. So very simple, quite trivial thing in today's terms. But yeah, you had marauding fullbacks like Paul Breitner, who is actually in my team, but in the midfield position as well. So yeah, Lahm would be getting plenty of action in the opposition half, no problem.
Okay. All right. And on the other side, on the left, it'd be taking up that position.
So that was another interesting decision for me. I think left backs in Germany haven't been quite as prominent over the last 30 odd years or 40 years since I've been watching. It was often the case that they were either wing backs or quite defensive. But the guy who really revolutionized the position in many ways was Brigitte Lizarazu of France and Bayern, because Lizarazu had a huge hand in Bayern switching to a back four after winning the Champions League in 2001, which sounds very late, but shows you that Germany by that time had become a little bit conservative. And Lizarazu being a modern fullback and an outstanding player helped that transition and effectively helped coach some of his teammates to play in a flat back four rather than the sweeper system. So for that alone, I have to give it to him. But I also just always enjoyed playing him, and he's a lovely, lovely guy as well. So Brigitte Lizarazu, left back.
Love that shout. Yeah, I used to love a bit of Lizarazu growing up, and he's a bit like Lahm, isn't he? In many ways, but on the other side, and that sort of back five in the 98 World Cup that France had, him being a massive part of that and making it one of the pretty best back fives ever, really.
Indeed.
So, yeah. And then the centre-back, the lone centre-back holding the fort there, who have you gone for?
Well, it's got to be someone special if he's going to be just the one lonely centre-back. And I think the best one in modern times is a guy called Jürgen Kohler, who had a huge role in Dortmund winning the Champions League in 1997. Especially his games against Manchester United and the semi-final were absolutely legendary, and Dortmund squeezed through. He also won the World Cup with Germany. Top, hard as nails, no-nonsense centre-back, but obviously very skillful as well and very intelligent. Went to Italy, played for Bayern, Dortmund and the national team. So it doesn't really get any better, I think, than him, and he definitely deserves this place among what we will see will be very many Bayern greats. He belongs in there as well.
Yeah, was he the captain of that Dortmund side that won it?
I think the captain was Michael Zorc at the time. I'm not 100% sure. But no, it wasn't. I don't think it was Kohler.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so who could he sort of be compared with in the modern day? Or something similar to him now?
Sort of a vintage character, the way he played.
Okay.
Just a very hard sort of man-marking centre-back.
Yeah. Okay. And then I can imagine who you might play for this sweeper-type position in front. But, yeah, who's sort of just in front of Kohler?
It could be Lothar Matthäus, who played that role for many, many years, but it is indeed Matthias Sammer, player of the year in 1996.
That is what I thought you were going to say, to be fair. Yeah.
The player that was really instrumental in making Germany win the Euros in 1996. Unfortunately, his career did not quite deliver as much as it could have done if he'd been less injury prone. There was also a spell in Italy, which didn't go well for him, and he came back. But an absolutely superb player who could have played a number of positions, but I'm putting him in the sweeper role because I think he enjoyed it most playing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the last sort of defensive players to win the Ballon d'Or as well, wasn't it? Just, I think he was the one before Cannavaro to
yeah,
do that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he's at Bayern now, isn't he? He's some sort of on the board somewhere.
He was a sporting director, but he left a few years ago, and now he's an advisor to the Dortmund board.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember when I sort of saw that at the time when he was at Bayern, I thought, well, that's as a Dortmund legend, I don't think you could make that sort of move. But then again, we've seen players make that move so many times that I guess the rivalry is a bit less in Germany, or a bit, is it just different? Because, I mean, I guess you wouldn't.
They don't really consider themselves rival in the sense that it's a historic rivalry. Yes, they've had some success at similar times, and they've had some huge games, none of them bigger so than the Champions League final in 2013, but it's not like going from Dortmund to Schalke, which is really contentious. Dortmund don't really look at Bayern as their hated rival.
Who would Bayern be Bayern? Would it be 1860 then, or would it be?
Well, Bayern's problem is that they've outgrown all of their rivals domestically, and the team that they like to beat most is Real Madrid.
Yeah, they had an astonishing record, didn't they, for years. Madrid couldn't win Bayern Munich. I think they only did it. Was it that time that they won 4-0? I think that was the first time they might have done it in their history.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Okay, so you've got your 3-3-1, are we calling it? What have you got in midfield? Have you got sort of a flat four or?
My midfield is a three, sort of two number sixes and one eight. The holding midfielders, none of them are truly holding midfielders, it has to be said. They all like to be box to box and get involved, but I'm sure we'll find a way to make it work. Starting with Paul Breitner, the first real one of the first real stars when I grew up, the player that I wanted to be, the player whose boots I had. Wonderful, wonderful player, elegant, dominated the game, popped up in a number of positions, never gave up, huge, huge presence, big goals, part of this really fantastic duo with Karl-Heinz Rummenigge at the time in the early 80s. And He, as I said earlier, he played as a left back for both Bayern and Germany in the '70s. Then went to Real Madrid and then came back and played as a real number eight. But I think he'd be okay for a game or two to be slightly more defensive in my formation. And I think he'll be happy that he's made the best Bundesliga ever side.
Yeah, because it was during the, I suppose in your lifetime, you would have only got the sort of last few years of his career, wasn't it? Because I think he sort of was in that 74 side, so I guess he would have stopped playing within probably 10 years of that, would he? So he might have put last.
Yeah, that's right.
Three or four.
He retired from Bayern in 83 or 84.
Yeah.
But for those years that I watched him, he was just absolutely on a different level to anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's such a big name. He's one of the... And obviously, I think Beckenbauer and Müller's going to be the first two that you sort of learn about in those historic German sides, especially the one in the 70s. But Breitner's right up there. And yeah, obviously getting the big goal in the World Cup final as well. And Real Madrid as well. I mean, you were saying earlier, like, it's not typical that Germans sort of tend to move abroad so much. And he's definitely the sort of first one I can remember that played in a big European team. I know a lot of them moved to Serie A, didn't they, in the 80s and...
Yeah, but it was a big problem because at the time, in the 70s, if you moved abroad, basically you were considered ineligible for the national team. So it was a big step. It wasn't just changing your job. It was really saying, okay, I can't play for Germany anymore. And that's why players like Gerd Müller, who had a deal with one of the Spanish clubs, never moved. And the likes of Uwe Seeler and even Beckenbauer only moved in the latter stages of his career when he felt he'd already done everything there was to do with Germany.
Yeah.
When he moved to New York. So, yeah, it wasn't as straightforward as it is now at the time.
So was he not getting picked then when he was at Madrid?
Yeah. I mean, he basically resigned from the German national team.
Yeah.
And then only came back in 82 for the World Cup.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, I never knew that. I mean, I know it happened a lot in the 50s. And I mean, Real Madrid sort of made the most of that. And they got, likes of Puskas and Di Stefano. And they sort of stopped playing for their national teams and stuff. But yeah, I didn't realise it was still going on to the 70s and 80s. And I mean, what's your thoughts on keeping German players in the Bundesliga? Do you think it benefits the national team? Because I know it's a discussion that's sort of going on with the English national team a lot about is it better for them to be going abroad and playing, or is it better for them to be playing in the Premier League? What do you think about German players in the Bundesliga?
Well, I think for the Bundesliga, it's great if the German player stays around as long as they can. But for the players themselves, and then I think for the national team, it's probably good if they play at the best level possible. So if you have an offer to go from a mid-table team in Germany, like let's say Leverkusen, they're not mid-table, it's a bit unfair to them, but top four side, top six side, to the Premier League, to one of the better sides in the Premier League, then you have to take it. And then I think the national team eventually benefits from that. Kai Havertz, who knows what would have happened to him if he'd still be playing for Leverkusen. He might be even a better player because he gets more game time. Maybe slightly different formation, maybe suiting him more, but at the same time, I think playing for Chelsea at such a young age, winning the Champions League at such a young age, that can only really help in his development and making him more versatile, rounded, more mature player. So I don't think that anyone can begrudge these players if they're good enough to make the next step. And the next step can only ever be Bayern, Dortmund, or then somebody abroad, because there's nowhere else to go if you're in the Bundesliga.
Do many people go to the Leipzig? Are they the most hated club in Germany, would you say? Or is that be Bayern?
Well, they're disliked for different reasons.
Yeah.
Bayern is for historic reasons, for their success. Leipzig for their lack of history. And whether they're successful or not, I don't think matters that much. People resent the business model. People resent the fact that they exist in the first place.
Yeah.
But this is something that the ultras, the diehard fans get upset about. The more casual fan will dislike Bayern because they're sort of Manchester United and Liverpool rolled into one, but probably doesn't have any strong feelings about Leipzig one way or the other. They're not yet a destination for players because it's not their business model. They want players who aren't yet stars, and then they want to keep them as long as they can, but they know that they will sell them. And that's how they keep sort of building, and that is their unique selling point for attracting the likes of Keita and Mane and Guardiola and Nkunku. It's part of the deal that they will play, and then they will be able to go if the right offer comes in.
Yeah.
Because Leipzig cannot play the kind of wages that will keep them there for longer.
Yeah, they're a very interesting model. I mean, I guess, how does it work with the 50+1 rule for them then? Does that model still work with that?
What they've done is basically subverted the rules. They pay lip service to them. They have a membership system. They have votes. But the membership is severely restricted. You have to pay a lot of money to become a member, and therefore it's effectively controlled by the main sponsor, the Red Bull Group, which is not technically an owner because you're not allowed to own the club, but in reality determines what happens. And it is that shall we say, creative attitude to adhering to the rules, stroke bending them, that makes people quite upset because they say, well, we follow the rules. We don't have a sponsor. We don't have a big owner really behind us. And you are basically flouting the regulations, and that doesn't create a level playing field. So that's really the reason why a lot of fans of other clubs really dislike them.
Yeah. I can imagine, and we're starting to see this thing a bit more now. This is what the City Football Group, I think that's got sort of five or six clubs in there they're requiring as well. So it's a trending thing at the minute. It's definitely on the up. I can see why people don't get on with that, especially as, you know, Germany is one of the few, I suppose, major nations in Europe that you do see big crowds every week, and it's very well supported, whereas, you know, you might look to sort of Serie A and the lower reaches of Spain, and they're struggling to fill sort of 10,000, whereas, yeah, Germany seems to be a lot of clubs very well supported and wrapped up in the history. So I'm not a fan of the Leipzig thing, but it's interesting to see how that kind of develops, and I guess to extend that sort of City Football Group and all this stuff as well. But if we get back onto your midfield, so you had another six in there, did you, with Paul Breitner?
Yeah, and again, he's not really a six, but really a true eight, so apologies. But Stefan Effenberg, probably the most underrated of German midfielders, underrated because internationally, his prime coincided with Germany being quite rubbish and him being a little bit immature. He was sent home from the World Cup 1994 for showing middle finger to the fans. And he then never really came back, which is why his exploits, if you will, were restricted to his time at Fiorentina and Gladbach, and then Bayern in the second spell when he won the Champions League. So not many people would have seen much of him, but he was just in his prime, an incredible player. A player who, and I say this without any exaggeration or hyperbole, dominated the likes of Vieira and Keane, just because of his presence, his height, his technique. He nutmegged Keane in the semi-final of the 2001 Champions League. And it was just an incredible player. Scored goals, a real leader. I just absolutely loved watching him. And I fought long and hard whether Michael Ballack might get the nod ahead of him, and there would have been many good reasons. But I think Effenberg at his very best was just a little bit better.
That's really interesting. I would never have thought you would have picked Effenberg, because I think for me, so probably when I got into football around the year sort of 2000, you'd probably hear more about Effenberg off the pitch than actually on it. And yeah, I think he did have this reputation of being a bit of a hothead and a bit of a maverick and stuff. And yeah, I guess that's why you say he's very underrated, because I guess people don't always talk about the football. But was he one of them that could do everything then, really? Like a Swiss Army knife of a player? Or...
No, not sure about everything, because he's so tall and an out-and-out sort of central midfielder. But I was just so dominating and just so technically good. Yeah. His passing range, his free kicks. Just, you know, the guy who would win the crucial tackle in the game. It's just a fantastic, fantastic midfielder.
Right. And again, the guy in front, I could probably guess who it might be. But yeah, who is that in that sort of number eight role in your midfield?
Well, I don't think it comes as a great surprise that a certain Mr. Lothar Matthäus makes the top 11 in this slightly more forward role, although he could easily be an eight as well. He started out as a holding midfielder for the German national team, where he marked Diego Maradona in 1986 World Cup final and managed to restrict Maradona to one key pass, but that one key pass won the game in extra time, or just before extra time, I should say. For many, many reasons, Matthäus needs to be in there. His longevity for a start, he played until he was 40 years old in the Bundesliga. He, of course, had a few years in Inter, but before that, he was already a superstar with Gladbach as a youngster, then with Germany, then with Bayern for the German national team. And then, of course, his big spell, second spell with Bayern, when they won absolutely everything apart from the Champions League, when he was substituted 5 minutes before the end of 1999. But he was, I think, the single most gifted player when it comes to the ability to run past players, shoot with his left and his right, and score unbelievable goals with volleys, shots from distance, even the odd header. Just a superb player, a little bit old-fashioned in the sense that he would do everything, you know, win the ball at the back, then move from midfield, then be at the end of his own through ball and scored a goal. They don't really make them like that anymore. Some issues off the pitch as well, like Stefan Effenberg, but on the pitch, just a force of nature. And the guy that I think on the whole I looked up to most, being in my sort of teenage and years and 20s. Yeah, Matthäus is the guy that dominated German football for a generation with his style and personality.
Would you say, well, I've got a couple of questions on Matthäus then. Would you say that he's the best player that you've ever seen play in the Bundesliga?
Probably the best midfielder.
Yeah.
Probably the best midfielder.
Okay. Yeah. So we might get into someone a bit further up then that might say that. And then TB, your favourite ever player?
Lothar?
Yeah.
No, another member of my top 11 is one of my favourite players ever.
Okay.
Player that we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah. Okay. So you've got a 3-1-3. Have you then got the sort of three classic, three up front, one striker and two wingers, or is it a little bit
one striker? One striker and two wide strikers. One of them is not a winger, but he did play slightly on the left, so it is his natural position. And I can start with him if you want. It's a guy called Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, who is my all-time favourite player.
Okay.
Again, slightly underrated in a strange way, because he was unlucky at two World Cups. In 78, he was very good, but Germany weren't, so it's a bit forgotten. And in 82, Germany were successful without playing very well, and he was very injured in both those World Cups and only played a bit part. Scored very big, important goals, but didn't quite show his best, which is why I think outside of Munich and Inter, where he is an absolute legend from his spell in the 80s, he's not as appreciated as he should be. He twice won the European Player of the War, the Ballon d'Or, at a time when the likes of Messi and when the likes of Maradona were around. Maradona wouldn't have been eligible, but Rummenigge was for a couple of years considered as exciting, as good a player as Maradona. And he was just the most naturally gifted dribbler and goal scorer, and just so exciting that the whole stadium kind of knew once he touched the ball, things would happen. So I absolutely loved the guy. And I think he definitely needs to be in the top three ever. Certainly since I sort of started watching football consciously in 1980.
Yeah, I mean, for someone that's won a couple of Ballon d'Ors, we don't hear too much about him when we're talking about the greats. I mean, it's a bit like Kevin Keegan to an extent as well. Like, he won a couple of Ballon d'Ors and, you know, a legend at two big clubs, but probably outside of those clubs didn't get the love, maybe because of not winning as much or getting as many caps on the international stage, maybe. But yeah, so what was Rummenigge's sort of style of play?
Really modern centre forward, I would say. Kind of Aguero style, would play close to the last defender and then make a run, but it would also link up really well. Lots of 1-2s with him and Breitner. Could go alone, could go deep, could dribble, was strong, tall, you know, would win headers. Really a complete centre forward with some wonderful technical ability, would score overhead kicks and volleys and all sorts of stuff. Have a look at one of his goals from the 1978 World Cup. He basically dribbles past a whole team. I think it's Chile, and scores a wonderful goal. Just a fantastic player.
All right. And then where do you want to go next? Do you want to go the centre forward or the right winger?
Let's go with the right winger. Another Bayern player, as I had warned you. They would feature heavily, but there is no denying that the best Bundesliga players invariably ended up at Bayern. And this is a guy who I think individually played at a level that very, very few, if at all any, wide forwards did in the last 40 years, and that guy is Arjen Robben. Again, slightly undervalued perhaps because of his injury problems and the fact that he didn't quite fulfill his potential at Chelsea, and it took him a bit of time to really win the big trophies. Bayern had a chance to win the World Cup and Casillas thwarted it. But in just in sheer terms of excitement, of speed, of doing one thing so well that even though you know it's coming, there's absolutely nothing you can do against it.
In his
case, cutting in on the from the right onto his left foot and then smashing it usually into the far corner. I don't think I don't remember seeing a player like him ever really. That kind of style, that kind of individual, pure individual class. We haven't really enjoyed many of them at this level, and I can't think anyone who's even come close, with the exception of Franck Ribéry, his Bayern teammate. And when it comes to the individual impact that he's had on the team in the last 20 years.
Yeah, we're seeing quite a lot of teams playing with inverted wingers now. And that's what would you say, Robin's and Ribéry, I suppose, to an extent, like, are they the pioneers for that? Because they're the first ones that I can remember doing that so well. I mean, sometimes you might have one, I guess, one out of the two, but those, they were both inverted and both played to such high level. So, yeah, would you say they sort of started the trend on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure they started it, but they certainly demonstrated just how effective it could be. And it made a huge difference when Robin came in. Franck Ribéry had already been there a couple of years, but he'd been a little bit lonely, you know. And once Louis van Gaal said, well, we need another guy on the other side who's just as good to have that balance. Robin comes in 2009. And really Bayern change, and Bayern then become the Bayern that we've experienced in the last decade. It wasn't just the Lahms and Schweinsteigers and the Neuers, but also Ribéry and Robin, who took Bayern to this completely different level, and had a big role in Bayern making it to three Champions League finals in 3 years, and of course winning one.
Yeah, getting the big goal in the final, because must have haunted him the year before with that penalty miss. But I suppose he has shown he can do it in the big moments. Did he ever rep in Germany of not turning up to before that point, or was that not really the narrative there?
Well, there was a suggestion or an accusation, if you will, that he didn't score in the big games because he'd had that big chance in 2010 in the final and he missed it. And of course, he had the penalty in extra time against Chelsea and missed it. So there was a bit of a reputation for him not taking those big chances when they arrive. And then, of course, he does score the winning goal for Bayern in 2015 against Dortmund, just two or three minutes before the end of the game, and that then puts that debate to bed. So it was a big game and a big goal for both for the club, but also for him personally.
And it was pretty much the last minute of the game, wasn't it, as well? So, yeah, even more crucial time. So your centre forward rounding off the team, who have you gone with there? There's a few to choose from, I suppose, but yeah,
There's a couple to choose from. I mean, I could have technically, and maybe should have technically, chosen Gerd Müller because he did play in my lifetime. But as I said earlier, I have no recollection of him. Mm. And then when it comes to the 1980s and 90s, and even early noughties, it's quite strange. You look at the leading goal scorers for every year, and they don't tend to score many goals. They're sort of in their low 20s. No one comes close to the amount of goals that this guy has scored and keeps maybe scoring for Bayern. We'll have to wait and see. But of course it is Robert Lewandowski. He's got 312 goals in the Bundesliga. If he continues, I think he might catch Gerd Müller's all-time record of 365. He did already smash Gerd Müller's single season record of 40 goals with 41 in 2020 and 21. And if you include the fact that he was also outstanding for Dortmund and is not just a Bayern great, then I think there is no one that can argue with his selection. An absolute goal machine, phenomenally durable, hardly ever misses games, injured, scores with every part of his body, and yeah, very rarely has an off day or an off night. So yeah, I think in terms of sheer volume, we have to give it to Robert Lewandowski.
Yeah. And I know this is, you know, we're in the Messi-Ronaldo era, but Lewandowski, are you having him as the third best this era?
I think he comes close. He perhaps hasn't been third best throughout Messi and Ronaldo, that little bit older, started dominating a little bit earlier.
That longevity that they've got, I think, is...
Yeah, is, I mean, if you think back to Ronaldo already making waves in 2006 and Messi being a good player then, Lewandowski's a little bit later, he comes to the scene. And his big breakthrough moment is only in 2012. So by that time, Messi's already won two Champions League trophies. Ronaldo's already won one Champions League trophy. So, and the fact that he didn't play for either Madrid or Barca, but for Bayern, made it, of course, that little bit harder for him to win the Champions League. And playing for Poland, he was never going to win any competition. Whereas both Messi and Ronaldo, of course, had opportunities and took opportunities to win international trophies with their country. So he was a little bit disadvantaged in that respect. And also his game, I think, is much more efficient. He's a goal scorer. He doesn't really do the fancy stuff. He doesn't really dribble past players too much. He doesn't score the big brash goals that we've seen from Cristiano. He has more of an assassin, a hitman, the guy who does the job and does it really well. I mean, of course, he scored some outrageously beautiful and difficult goals. And his technique is fantastic, but perhaps not as eye-catching as both Ronaldo and Messi were. But he won, I think, mine too much. The fact is that he has been the most successful Bundesliga striker in modern times. And even if you take away a few of those goals because Bayern have been so dominant and you think maybe they don't quite count as much as if they'd been scored in a different time or a different place, it'd still be the most impressive modern goal scorer in the Bundesliga if you take away 100 goals. Lewandowski has just been incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't understand why in 2020 they scrapped the Ballon d'Or, because I think they made that decision a bit too early, really, because all, I guess, you know, we didn't have the Euros, but Champions League and the leagues mostly finished and stuff like that. And I mean, he was pretty much guaranteed, wasn't he, for that one. And what do you think about last year's Ballon d'Or? Because for me, he definitely should have got it then as well. So he should probably have two to his name.
Yeah, I think he was very unlucky last year, but the Ballon d'Or does tend to go to players who do something special in the big games, whether that's international level or in club football, in the Champions League. I think, you know, you look at this year's Champions League final, I think if Mo Salah scores a goal, he might have a shot at the Ballon d'Or, but his shot is saved. And therefore, it's probably going to Karim Benzema. The margins are so fine.
Yeah.
And these are players that could both equally be considered the best player in the world right now. And then they're really being recognized for what their club tend to do rather than they themselves necessarily. So it's not always a true reflection, but popularity contests tend to have an element of sort of randomness and maybe iniquity about them. That's just how it is.
Yeah. Do you think the Bundesliga is sort of on the wrong end of that then? Because I think it might be Sammer that's the last player from the Bundesliga to win a Ballon d'Or, which is pretty insane, really. I mean, I know we've had Ronaldo and Messi dominating it for years and years, but yeah, so I think it's been 25 years that it's been a major league not having a player to win it, and even then it wasn't even a Bayern player, so I think you're probably going back to the 70s. It would have been Rummenigge, wouldn't it, in the early 80s for a Bayern player to win it. I mean, do you think the Bundesliga's sort of it's been unfairly voted in that sense, or is it just we're seeing, certainly in the last sort of 10, 15 years, just these insanely greatest of all time level players in Messi?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. First of all, in the Ronaldo Messi era, it was difficult for anyone to rise above the parapet and get recognition. You can look at the amount of times Premier League players have been anywhere near this role to see that it's just very, very hard over the last 10, 15 years. Secondly, as you said, the Bundesliga itself doesn't quite have the visibility. Bayern only ever have it when they win the Champions League. And I think Lewandowski was supremely unlucky in 2020. I think it would have been an absolute natural choice, a shoe-in really for the vote if it had happened with L'Equipe. And thirdly, I think there's another reason, which when it comes to German players and them winning stuff with the German national team, for example, they tend to be team efforts. You know, they tend to be one because collectively Germany turn up and make the most of their abilities, but you find it quite hard taking out one player and say, here's the reason why Germany won the World Cup in 2014. Just too many of them who are important without ever really being outstanding in the way that individuals are, and maybe with the possible exception of Neuer, but you know, giving it to a goalkeeper was always going to be hard, I think, for the voters in 2014. So those three factors, I think, come together. But let's see. Let's see what happens. We got the World Cup coming up, and I'm reasonably hopeful that we're going to see a strong Germany play and turn up, and then maybe we'll get another shot at it.
Yeah. Have you got any sort of tips for either German or Bundesliga players that you think might break out of that World Cup and sort of rise to stardom?
Well, I'm hoping that Florian Wirtz will recover from his injury and will play a big role, but it might be a little bit too tight with his knee injury. I hope that he makes a full recovery. He's been absolutely superb for Leverkusen. I think Havertz has a shot at being really influential for Germany, probably playing as a false nine in the formation. I think Jamal Musiala is incredibly talented and will be an heir to Toni Kroos or Thomas Müller, depending on his exact position in due course. So there's real talent there. Whether it's quite enough to win the World Cup, we'll have to wait and see. But I think that'd be very competitive. And maybe if Bayern can give a slightly better account of themselves in the Champions League, then let's see if we can have that conversation again.
Yeah, I think Germany, the future is definitely bright, and as they always seem to do, they're probably going to do very well at this World Cup as well. But Raf, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Very very interesting team, very strong team, possibly the best we've had on our sort of feature session series. But yeah, cheers for coming on, and remember to keep it.